From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
New stumbling blocks for crisis diplomacy. Hello again, I'm Owen Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. One day before his meeting with President Bush, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki was hit by two challenges to his leadership of Iraq. The first, a leaked memo from a top White House advisor saying al-Maliki is either unwilling or unable to control sectarian violence. The second, withdrawal from al-Maliki's government by a key bloc of supporters led by Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. On To the Point, how damaged is al-Maliki's leadership of his own divided country? Would more American troops make a difference? On Reporter's Notebook later on, honeybees trained to detect explosives. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Marvin Alney, back with To the Point. President Bush is in Jordan for talks with Iraq's Prime Minister al-Maliki, who's been jolted by new challenges to his leadership and his diplomatic credibility. On To the Point, does al-Maliki have the power to control his own country? Would more American troops make a difference? On Reporter's Notebook, we'll hear how honeybees are being trained to sniff out explosives. First, this news update. In a secret memo linked to the New York Times today, National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley says Prime Minister al-Maliki may lack the capacity or even the will to control sectarian violence. The memo says al-Maliki is either ignorant of the reality on the streets of Baghdad, misrepresenting his own intentions, or unable to turn his intentions into effective action. Peter Walston of the Los Angeles Times is with the president in Jordan, traveling at the moment on a bus in that country. Peter Walston, good to have you on our program.
Thanks, Warren. How you doing?
Good. The White House says that the meeting scheduled for tonight, dinner meeting with the president and Prime Minister al-Maliki, has now been postponed. What appears to be the reason for that?
Well, I wish I knew exactly. The White House is saying that it was postponed simply because the Prime Minister al-Maliki and King Abdullah, who's also was going to be at the meeting, already had a meeting earlier today. So they said that that it just wasn't necessary for Maliki to be there again, and instead President Bush and King Abdullah would have their own bilateral meeting together alone, and then Maliki and Bush would meet in the morning. And the White House is saying that this is that nothing much should be read into this, other than the fact that it was a scheduling issue.
What would be read into it if one didn't take the advice of the White House?
You know, there was this, as you mentioned earlier, there was this memo that was that came out in the New York Times this morning, where the National Security Advisor Steve Hadley had some things to say about Maliki that perhaps weren't the most complimentary. You know, that certainly put the meeting in a different context, certainly a different context than the White House was planning and when they first announced the meeting. So there's certainly that possible complication. There's also political issues in Iraq. Maliki's got some issues with his fellow Shiites there in charge. There's a threatened boycott. So, you know, there's a context to this postponement, and one could read that into it.
Once again, Peter Walston is on a bus in Amman, Jordan, and the transmission from his cell phone seems to get better and worse. I think, however, it's still clear what he is saying, especially about the memo, that what we have here is a new context for these meetings, because Stephen Hadley is such a significant leader in the White House or staff person in the White House, and his comments would appear to be very critical of al-Maliki. Is the White House saying they still have confidence in al-Maliki?
The White House is saying that, yes. They're saying that they still have confidence in him, and they believe that his intentions are pure, and they have faith in him. They just say that they said that the proper way to interpret the memo is that they have conditions about concerns about his capabilities to lead in Iraq. That it's not necessarily about his intentions, as the memo suggests, but it's more about the situation on the ground and what he's up against.
Has al-Maliki or anyone with him had any response, any public response to this memo?
I have not seen any response from Maliki yet. I was hoping to see that, but as he said, I've just actually gotten off a bus and stepped into the hotel here, so I'm hoping to get that soon.
Okay, I hope you can find your bags there in Jordan. We have a couple of minutes left. This memo was drafted, interestingly enough, on November 8th, the day after the Republicans lost so badly in the congressional elections. Any indication as to whether or not it was motivated by the idea that they had to take a new look at their whole situation?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point, Warren. You know, Steve Hadley went to Baghdad and met with Maliki a week earlier, I believe October 30th, if I recall correctly. But the big event in the United States that is leading to some of these, to perhaps a new look at the Iraq situation, was the election. It was the Iraq War that dominated the debate in the election. That is what drove President Bush's approval ratings down, and that is what led the president after the elections to say that he got the message and that he's going to, he's going to consider other ideas for what should happen in Iraq. So it's certainly, I would think that it's not coincidental, or it's reasonable to think that it's not coincidental that memo, very detailed memo, gets drafted the next day, and certainly seems to reflect the way the administration is looking at the situation in Iraq now.
It's a long memo. We just have a few seconds left, but what were the major new ideas in it that the president was asked to consider?
Well, I'm not sure that there were any major new ideas. The important revelation of the memo is that it reflected what one could at least interpret a lack of confidence in Maliki. And despite the fact that the White House is assuring everybody that they do have faith in Maliki, there's some pretty strong language in the memo. They talk about him being either ignorant of the situation on the ground or misrepresenting his goals. And it's interesting that they actually imply in the memo, Steve Hadley does, that one of the problems is Maliki is amassing power with his own Shiite faction in the government, and perhaps that's counterproductive when you're, on the other hand, trying to create a unity government.
Peter Walston, just arriving at the hotel in Jordan, there to cover President Bush. Thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome, Warren.
White House correspondent for the New York Times. In a moment, withdrawal of crucial support for al-Maliki's government and the options available for new policies on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Hours after Stephen Hadley's memo was leaked, Prime Minister al-Maliki's political support was severely weakened. Members of parliament and cabinet members loyal to Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr pulled out of the government. Bobby Ghosh is senior correspondent for Time magazine based in Baghdad. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Anytime.
The threat to withdraw from the government because of the meeting between al-Maliki and President Bush has been made before, but it hasn't. There's no action been taken. Does it appear that the memo was a sort of triggering force?
No, I don't believe the memo was a triggering force. The group, these are 30 members of parliament and 6 cabinet ministers, had threatened to suspend their participation in the government if Maliki went to Amman. And since Maliki did go to Amman, that was the main trigger.
It is said that this is temporary in some way. What do you suppose that means?
Yes, I think the fact that they've chosen to suspend their participation, it's a very carefully chosen phrasing, rather than withdraw from the government or boycott the parliament, I think that leaves open the door for them to come back. These are people who recognize that they have more to gain from being inside the tent than outside. And they also know that al-Maliki wants them inside the tent. They are now, I suspect, holding out for some sort of concession. They want to be cajoled and pleaded with to come back into parliament. This is mainly political posturing, nothing more than that.
So you don't think then that is a serious threat to al-Maliki's being able to hold on to his job?
I don't think it's a serious threat, but it does make him look even more emasculated than he already is. If he makes a concession to these people to bring them back into the tent, it will only confirm what the other communities in Iraq, the Shiites and the Kurds, already suspect, that al-Maliki is essentially a Shiite partisan who makes special favors for Shiite parties. So it will certainly weaken him even more. But I doubt very much that this group will force him out of politics. They get more from him being prime minister than from him being outside.
What effect does it have on the ability of the parliament to get anything done? There have been a lot of reports that it's at a kind of political impasse.
Well, the parliament has been locked in a political impasse on most of the important issues confronting Iraq for weeks and months now. And I think when Prime Minister Maliki returns from his summit with Bush, it would be hard for him to get the parliament to come back and hold some sort of realistic discussions. A lot will depend on what sorts of promises he can extract from the Americans at the summit in Jordan. If he has something positive to bring back to parliament, I think he might get a little cooperation. But I'm not holding my breath.
Specifically, what promises would he want from President Bush?
That is the main reason why I'm not holding my breath. It is far from clear what President Bush or the United States can do at this stage to help al-Maliki out. The problems that confront Iraq now are political rather than military. It is up to him to crack down on the Shiite militias and bring an end to the sectarian violence. I suspect what he'll hear from President Bush is more of the same. President Bush will speak to him sternly in private, perhaps, and more diplomatically in public. But the message will be, you have to fix this problem. You have to face down your Shiite militias before the United States can do anything to help you.
My understanding is that the Ayatollah Sistani, who is so powerful in Iraq, has indicated to all of the Shiite parties that what's very important is for them to stick together so that they can continue to dominate the political process. Is it likely that Maliki could go to the Ayatollah and say, you know, we really need to get the militias under control and get his blessing?
Well, al-Maliki did almost exactly that last month when he went to Najaf to see Ayatollah Sistani. One of the big stories in Iraq recently is that Ayatollah Sistani's influence over events has been fading, and it's been replaced by the voice, the radical and anti-American voice of Muqtada al-Sadr. Al-Sadr is not a religious leader of the caliber of Sistani, but his fiery rhetoric appeals far more to Shiites in this time than Sistani. So there are serious doubts about how much Ayatollah Sistani can influence the daily course of events in Iraq right now.
Given the extraordinary level of violence that's been going on now for months, of course, but very much increased just in the past few days, what would the reaction be in Iraq? What would the effectiveness be, do you think, if the president decided to increase the number of troops, as he's indicated he might?
Well, I think most Iraqis that I meet, and I have to say these are people in Baghdad, so they're cosmopolitan, they are educated, and tend to have a more internationalist worldview. Most people here would welcome that. I think they recognize that the United States is the only credible military force in the country at the moment. Their own army and police force are unable or unwilling to stop the violence, and nobody else is willing to help. So if the U.S. is willing to send more troops, I think most people would welcome that. But there have been mixed messages here. On the one hand, there is talk of the U.S. sending more troops to Baghdad. On the other hand, there is talk of the U.S. withdrawing its military presence in the western province of Anbar, which is the heartland of the Sunni insurgency. So most Iraqis are quite confused about America's intentions. And one of the many things they will be hoping to get out of the summit between President Bush and Prime Minister al-Maliki is some sort of clarity of America's intentions in Iraq in the short term.
And what about the idea that if the United States, if President Bush indicates to Prime Minister al-Maliki that he might withdraw troops sooner rather than later, in part because of the pressure he's getting here at home politically, would that in fact, do you think, cause al-Maliki to take a stronger action than he has against the Shiite militias?
I doubt very much that he can. The big problem is that Maliki's hands are already tied by his own political realities. He needs the support of the very Shiite militias that that he's being asked to crack down on. Without them, he cannot remain prime minister. So I doubt very much that he can act against them. The best that anybody can hope for at this stage is that he allows the U.S. To do the dirty work, if you like, while he steps back and does not interfere. That is about the best we can expect from the situation.
Bobby Goh, senior correspondent for Time magazine in Baghdad. Thank you so much for being with us.
Anytime.
Let's take a longer look at the situation here, a longer-term look at the situation with Noah Feldman. He's former senior advisor for constitutional law to the Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance in Iraq. He's currently a professor of law at New York University. Professor, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You have been supportive, obviously, of the American presence in Iraq, at least at some point. What do you think about its future?
That is indeed a broad-ended, open-ended question.
It is a very open-ended question.
I think my own view is that we have failed miserably at our most basic responsibility towards the Iraqi people, which has been to provide basic order, basic security in the society, and that much of the collapse of Iraq into civil war is a product of our not having sufficient troop strength present to really control things. Now, I think the question is whether there is any realistic prospect of getting the parties within Iraq, with the help of people in the region, to actually solve the fighting and the deepening civil war that's going on. If there is, and we could talk about how that might be done, our troops in the short term will probably have to play the role of guaranteeing the peace, of keeping the peace. We've shown now that we can't on our own make the peace, but we would still be important players in terms of keeping the peace in the absence of anyone else prepared to do it right now, in the absence of an Iraqi military or an Iraqi police force that is capable of doing that job in an objective and fair-minded way.
You said yourself there's a civil war going on. What peace is there to guarantee?
Well, at present, there isn't peace to guarantee. At present, our troops are simply trying to stop the civil war from getting deeper and becoming even more profound. And frankly, I would say we're not doing a very good job of that because the civil war is getting progressively worse and worse. That said, I think it's quite likely that a rapid withdrawal of our forces now would probably lead to the rapid further deepening of the civil war. And that means the question as to whether we should withdraw troops quickly or not really turns on whether it's inevitable that the civil war will get very bad, in which case you could say, well, we might as well do it now because we can't stop it anyway, or whether we think it is possible to cabin the civil war, to limit it, and then to use the opportunity of calming to some degree of the violence to work towards a political solution to the problem.
What's your position? Do you find it inevitable that things will get worse and we might as well go now, or do you think there are better options?
I don't think it's inevitable. I do think that it's probable. In other words, I wouldn't tell you that no matter what, we're headed for a full-on, all-out civil war in which hundreds of thousands of people die and populations move. But I do think that it's more likely than not that even with our best efforts, we'll end up somewhere like that. The point is, though, that we should still, I think, do what we can to stop that from happening, so long as there is some probability, some reasonable probability that we could avoid it. And I think that could happen. I think we're going to have to do, as probably Secretary Baker's study group will suggest, we're going to have to reach out to regional allies and to regional players who are not our allies to try to convince them that they don't have an interest in Iraq collapsing entirely. And we're going to have to probably give them some of the things they want to get them to get involved. That means we'll have to say things and do things vis-a-vis Iran and vis-a-vis Saudi Arabia that we might not otherwise be prepared to do. But we'll have to do that in order to salvage our position. And then I think with the help of those players, we could calm the violence and move in the direction of a settlement that enables the different political parties in Iraq to actually cabin some of the violence that's coming from their militias.
What could Iran, very specifically, do if, in fact, it were persuaded that it should be helpful to the idea of maintaining order in Iraq? What could it do?
Iran has a huge amount of leverage over the entire Shia political and military apparatus. For one thing, its money mostly comes from Iran, and if not in the short term, in the long run, it's certain to come from Iran. And so the Iranians simply telling the local militias that if they don't calm down their own use of violence, that their tap will be turned off, would be tremendously effective, provided the Iranians really meant it. Now, that doesn't mean that every street-level gang, and that's by the way, a lot of whom we're dealing with in Iraq, it's not just organized militias, it's also street-level gangs that, as it were, wear the colors of the militias, would listen to the Iranians. Some of Muqtada Sadr's angry young men will continue to do their own thing, regardless of what the Iranians say. But it does mean that over the long run, sustaining the Shia side in the civil war would not be viable without both tacit and practically Iranian support. So if the Iranians take that away, that'll have a big effect on the Shia.
What about Saudi Arabia?
it's more complicated in the case of the Saudis. It's not that the Saudi government is funding the Sunni insurgents, but it is the case that there are some private individuals with Saudi Arabia who have the capacity to give a lot of support to the insurgency. And it's also the case that some numbers, probably not very many, but some numbers of men are actually traveling from initially Saudi Arabia into Iraq. So probably what the Saudis could most effectively do is communicate to the Sunni community within Iraq that it does not have the support of Sunnis worldwide, that Sunnis worldwide do not want to see a long and bloody war between Iraqi Sunni and Iraqi Shia, and that in the long run, they will be supported, the Sunnis will be supported, and they'll have interests looked out for if they come to the table, but not if they continue the violence. And that is a message that I think Saudi Arabia can very effectively send on behalf of other Sunni Arab countries.
There have been reports recently that the insurgency, as it's called, is in fact self-sustaining, that it does enough smuggling and enough in the business of crime and kidnapping and in other ways to get enough money to keep itself going without outside support. Do you think that's true?
I think it's possible. I've been reading those pieces too, and I think they're extremely interesting. They certainly seem possible, especially because certain elements of an insurgency are relatively cheap to sustain. But I think even if we assume the worst, that it is true that the insurgency is self-sustaining, it's still the case that the insurgents are gambling that in a long, drawn-out war between them, the Sunni insurgency, and the Shia, that they will get support from the Sunni world, because they think to themselves that the rest of the Sunni world can't tolerate an Iraq in which Iran has the kind of role that it would have should the Shia be ultimately successful. So they sort of are gambling that they will get support from the broader Sunni world. Some, in fact, go so far as to say that in the long run, the United States itself, which has until now supported the Shia side here, would switch over and support the Sunni side because of the tensions between the United States and Iran. And so they need to be told, the insurgents need to be told, that that's not going to happen. And for them to be told that credibly, they need to hear of Sunni voices from outside. And the most credible Sunni voice from outside right now is still the Saudis.
Noah Feldman, once again, now professor of law at New York University, formerly the senior advisor for constitutional law to the Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance in Iraq. Well, Vice President Cheney's already been to Saudi Arabia, but with regard to Iran, President Bush continues to say that he's not going to talk to them or deal with them in any way unless they are willing to agree to suspend their enrichment of uranium. He's not going to do that, is he?
This is a terrible quandary, really, for the president, because on the one hand, he doesn't want it to be said about his historical legacy that Iran became a nuclear power on his watch. But on the other hand, he can't really afford for it to be on his historical legacy that Iraq ultimately collapsed into a failed state on his watch. And he may need to make some concessions with regard to the former in order to achieve the latter. Right now, I think the line from the White House is pretty clear that they wouldn't compromise on these nuclear questions. But a little bit down the line, they may discover that they can't really control the violence in Iraq without getting that kind of concession from Iran, and that may be the price.
Noah Feldman, I know you need to leave us. Thank you very much for the time you've given us.
Thank you for having me.
Again, formerly advisor to the Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance, now professor of law in New York. We're going to continue this conversation in just a moment on To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warman Olney back with To the Point. Talking today again about the president's visit to Jordan. His meeting tonight with Prime Minister al-Maliki of Iraq has been canceled. They won't meet now until tomorrow. The White House says it's a scheduling issue. Others are suggesting it might have something to do with the leaked secret memo from the president's own security advisor to the New York, printed in the New York Times today, indicating real doubts about al-Maliki's credibility on the one hand and his effort to actually do anything about sectarian violence in Iraq, even if he wants to. Al-Maliki, at the same time, losing at least temporarily some support from Shiite supporters that have been that are led by Muqtada al-Sadr, the Shiite cleric. Laith Kuba is former spokesman for the previous Iraqi prime minister, Ibrahim al-Jafari. He's now director for the Middle East and North Africa at the National Endowment for Democracy. Laith Kuba, always good to have you on our program.
Thank you.
Do you see anything? Let's take it first from the memo by Stephen Hadley Is there anything in there that would suggest a good way for the United States to help the prime minister and to perhaps ease the violence?
Well, I tell you, first, I was struck reading the memo that it has missed out on the fundamentals of what is missing in Iraq, what are the problems. It has listed a number of things it would like to see, but it's like a facelift rather than addressing the issues. For example, it talks about the requesting that the Prime Minister...
We seem to be having a problem with the transmission here with Laith Kuba. Can you hear me? Are you with us? Okay, we'll try to get him back on our program. In the meantime, we have with us Wayne White. He's an advisor now to the Iraq Study Group, this organization led by James Baker, the former Secretary of State, and Lee Hamilton, the former Democratic congressman. Now, Wayne White also served as Deputy Director of the State Department's Iraq Intelligence Team from 2003 to 2005. He's currently an adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute. And Wayne White, thank you for joining us.
Nice to be back, Warren.
Do you see any light at the end of the tunnel, either from Mr. Hadley's memorandum or anyplace else?
Not that much. I agreed very much with what I heard from your first two guests. The situation seems to be deteriorating much more rapidly than anybody suspected, even, say, 2 or 3 months ago.
In what ways is it deteriorating, and has it gone so far that some of the things we've heard about, trying to get al-Maliki to end the Shiite militia attacks on Sunnis, getting the Iranians, the Syrians, and others involved, is it too late for that sort of thing?
Well, al-Maliki is at the center of the storm, and I think your question is very well directed. The problem is that violence is accelerating greatly, and the perpetrators are not mainly the insurgents. They are militiamen and associated police who are affiliated with the government itself. And so for our forces, for example, they're effectively fighting a two-front war now, trying to hold off insurgents in Al-Anbar while trying to stifle the violence, and not doing a very good job because it's so widespread, from quarters that previously weren't problematic.
What about getting other countries involved, particularly Iran and Syria? Does that offer some hope?
Well, I think that's very interesting because, of course, it came up in the course of our deliberations with the ISG, and it seems appealing on the surface, and of course you want to do it, and I think we should get past the issue of stopping enrichment in order to engage the Iranians. But we should go in with very low expectations, and I'll tell you why. Let's just take Iran. The Iranians will want concessions from us in exchange for anything meaningful that they get or give back to us. This comes in the form of lifting sanctions, taking a more relaxed attitude toward their nuclear program overall, issues like this, which I don't think we can proffer. And then you get to the other point. If the Iranians do make concessions to us, do they keep their word? Almost all the activity that the Iranians and the Syrians are being accused of, and in most cases I agree that they're actually doing it, are highly covert, very hard to monitor. And so you could find out 3 or 4 months from now from an agreement that they're cheating, which would be very, very common, trying to get away with what they could.
Let me ask you to respond to one of the earlier topics that we talked about, and that is whether or not there's any point in American troops remaining in Iraq, or whether, on the assumption that things will get worse anyway, they ought to be pulled out.
I am drifting toward the view that it's getting time to lay out a timetable for withdrawal. This is a terrible decision because withdrawal, will cause Iraq, I believe, to descend into civil war. But if you can't prevent it and you're just postponing that civil war or tremendous ethno-sectarian strife and you're losing our young men and women in order to do so, I you really have to ask, is it worth staying?
Wayne White, again, advising the Iraq Study Group, a former deputy director of the State Department's Iraq Intelligence Team during the Bush administration, now an adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute. We do have back on the line Laith Kuba. Again, he was former spokesman for the Iraqi Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafari, who preceded al-Maliki. He is director now for the Middle East and North Africa at the National Endowment for Democracy. And Laith Kuba, let me pick up where I just left off with Wayne White. Do you think that it makes sense for the United States to simply withdraw?
Well, the question cannot be simplified as to withdraw or not to withdraw. I think withdrawal may be inevitable. The most important thing is that we need a replacement force. You cannot leave the country in vacuum. And I think that's the reason why regional involvement must be done on clear parameters, clear understanding with the U.S. Iraq needs a decisive force to put an end to this rising tide of violence, sectarian violence that is taking place in the country. So if you withdraw without defining the alternative, then basically you're going to raise the level of violence in the country.
When you say that there needs to be a greater force and we ought to talk to other countries, you're suggesting, I gather, that some of the neighboring countries might then send their own troops in. Which would be the most likely to do that?
Well, all of Iraq's neighbors have an interest in making sure Iraq does not disintegrate or breaks down. I think Turkey has a strong army that can be used as a deterrent. Saudi Arabia can bring a lot of influence, both in terms of its money and its relationship to other Arab countries. And Iran, of course, is most important. Now, if you do not hold a regional peace conference where the terms of engagement of these countries are defined, then what will happen next is each of these countries I've named will rush to decide their share of whatever will be left of Iraq. And that is just going to increase the level of violence in the country by many folds.
Who would have the credibility to call a regional conference and be able to get all of the different countries we've talked about, many of which have competing interests, to come to it?
I think the United States. It already has now an army of 150,000 plus in the country. It assumed exclusive responsibility in the last 3.5 years. It asked Iraq's neighbors in the past to stay away from the post-Saddam era. And I think if it calls for that conference now, people will respond to it in a positive way.
Given the level of violence in Iraq, the difficulty that American troops are having in helping to even keep it from increasing, why would the troops from neighboring countries have any better success?
Well, nobody is going to say it's going to be easy, but with one difference. Iraq's neighbors, each one of them, has a leverage, a major leverage over the politicians in Baghdad who are squabbling and disagreeing on how to fix the country. Iran has a leverage over the Shias. Saudi Arabia has a huge leverage over the Sunnis. And Turkey, in a way, in a negative way, has a leverage over the Kurds. So that would actually, if those countries agree what to do in Iraq, that would send a strong message to all of them. Time is up. Shape up, and we're sending some troops. And I think in 3 to 4 months, violence can subside in a significant way.
Laith Kuba, once again, former spokesman for the previous prime minister of Iraq. Let me go back to Wayne White, advisor to the Baker Study Group. Does the regional conference and the idea of bringing in foreign troops and other kinds of foreign influence, is that likely to be what the Baker Commission, the Iraq Study Group, is going to recommend?
I don't know what form it might come in, but I think a regional conference is going to be held. I think it's going to be called by Secretary Rice. It certainly should be attempted. But the neighbors are not going to send troops. Other Islamic states are not going to send troops. They've seen what's happened inside that country, and they don't want to lose their people. And so that's a very unlikely scenario. Another problem we've got to look out for is in the course of a regional conference, you can get people on the same page officially, but then after that, they can drift and basically go in their own directions and do what they want. And so it's still going to be a very dicey affair, even if a regional conference gains some agreement and advantage, just as I said before with respect to the Iranians. You're going to have people agreeing to X and then cheating and doing Y in defense of their own interests.
Let me ask you about Turkey. You said other countries wouldn't want to get their suffer casualties of the kind that would be likely. But if one of the alternative possibilities is for Iraq to split up into three, as have been actually advocated by some Americans, then wouldn't that make Turkey very nervous about the idea of a Kurdish state that might try to encroach on what's now Turkish territory? Wouldn't that be enough motivation to get the Turks in?
Well, it might create enough motivation for the Turks to play around with the Kurds along the border. But as a matter of fact, when we were trying to secure other contingents in Iraq to help us out, much closer to the time of the invasion, but after it, the Turks actually volunteered. Things hadn't gotten too bad at that point, and the Turks volunteered a rather hefty troop contribution, and the Iraqi government that we were working with was absolutely opposed to any Turkish involvement in Iraq. This goes back to the legacy of 500 years of Turkish occupation, of various Arab lands like Iraq.
Laith Kuba, back to you. What about the point that, yes, it's a good idea to have a conference, but you can't expect much from it, given that it's so easy to cheat?
Well, number one, for the very reason that each community does not want the other troops to come in, i.e. the Sunnis do not want the Iranians, the Shias do not want the Arab countries, and the Kurds do not want the Turks. That is exactly the reason why projecting that option would provide the deterrent necessary to clamp on the politicians who have created this mess. As far as cheating, I think those countries that I've named have genuine long-term vested interest in seeing Iraq not breaking down. If there is a Kurdish state, that would destabilize both Iran and Turkey. If there was a Shia state, that would destabilize Saudi Arabia. Those countries have an interest in seeing Iraq remaining united. And what it's needed is somebody to work out the politics of bringing them on the table and making them invest in Iraq's future.
Let me go back to the meeting between the president and the prime minister, now scheduled for tomorrow and tomorrow only. Laith Kuba, the prime minister has indicated that he would like more direct control over Iraq security forces, the army and the police. Is that something that the United States should concede?
Well, it's not in the hands of the United States, so to speak. That is defined by the Iraqi constitution, by parliament, by the way politics have been structured in the country. The fact that the prime minister is not in a position to exercise control does not indicate there is a problem with the U.S. It indicates there is a serious problem with the way Iraq is structured. And I think that is reason why really we need to visit whole of the way politics and government is set up in Iraq.
Let me ask you both this question, starting with Wayne White, a former deputy director of the State Department's Iraq intelligence team. What do you think is the best we can hope for from the meeting between the president and the prime minister?
That's a very good question, because I think what we will have there, and it was in one of the media accounts leading up to the meeting, is for President Bush to listen, for President Bush to take in the situation from the man at the center of the maelstrom. That is probably the best thing that can come out of the meeting, because a lot of the recommendations, for example, in the Hadley memo that's been leaked, are either not going to happen or are not going to achieve the results desired. And so what would be my best guess about the outcome would be that the president comes away with a much deeper understanding of the fundamental forces at work in this situation, and then returns to Washington much refreshed and able to deal with advice coming from the ISG.
the ISG being the Iraq Study Group, headed by James Baker. Well, let me ask you this: the Hadley memo says that Prime Minister al-Maliki has too small a group of advisors, most of them Shiites, such as he is himself. Are you suggesting that President Bush has too small a group of advisors?
Well, that's a hard question for me to answer. But it's interesting that you've touched upon one of those suggestions, which I don't really think will have much impact on the situation. Another, which is very, very questionable, is demanding that all government workers publicly renounce all violence in order to keep their jobs. Well, they'll all do that, and then they'll go back to doing what they were doing before anyway.
Leif Kuba, what do you think is the best result we can hope for from this meeting tomorrow?
I think if the Prime Minister and the President see eye to eye on what terms, workable terms, realistic terms of neighbors' involvement in Iraq can be agreed on, if they can achieve that, I think they will lay the foundation for the next phase and maybe put some hope into salvaging Iraq. It is not easy because, as we all know, the U.S. has issues with Iran and Syria, and we all know the Prime Minister himself in a very weak position to simply listen to what, to accommodate only U.S. terms on neighbors' involvement. If they can agree the parameters of how to constructively engage Iraq's neighbors, something that is doable, I think that would be the best thing to come out of the meeting.
Well, thank you both very much for being with us. We're certainly looking and see with great expectations what does come out of the meeting tomorrow. The White House is low-keying it at the moment, saying there probably won't be any major announcements, but the world is watching. Leif Kuba, again, at the National Endowment for Democracy, a former spokesman for the previous prime minister of Iraq. Thank you for being with us. Wayne White, a formerly deputy director of the State Department's Iraq intelligence team from 2003 to 2005. Thanks to you, again, now at the Middle East Institute. Thanks to our earlier guests as well, Noah Feldman and Bobby Ghosh. Los Alamos, New Mexico is best known as the place where the atomic bomb was developed and where research on nuclear weapons has continued ever since. It's also home to the Stealthy Insect Sensor Project. The stealthy insects are honeybees, and the project is training them to detect explosives. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to podcast this program, visit kcrw.com and click on KCRW A to Z.
We're Manali back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Los Alamos researchers say they are very excited about training honeybees to detect explosives in cars, in roadside bombs, in belts similar to those used by suicide bombers. Dr. Tim Harmon is principal investigator at the Stealthy Insect Sensor Project. Doctor, good to have you with us.
Good morning.
What characteristics are there that honeybees have that make them able to detect explosives?
Well, kind of the concept behind all this is, you know, bees naturally have a society that's based on pheromones and smell. So we know they have a really good sense of olfaction. So we kind of put to the test whether or not you could take bees and use them for explosives detectors. So the whole principle is kind of based on Pavlovian training, where you associate a sugar water reward for the bees with an explosive of interest, like C4 plastic explosives or TNT. And so you can put individual bees that you harness, and kind of looks like a drinking straw with tape over it. Each individual bee can't fly around. You train them on the benchtop, and after a couple hours, they are trained and can start responding to explosives. And the way that they respond is by sticking their proboscis out, which is just their tongue. You can imagine this is a real large tongue. It's bigger than their antennae. It's really obvious when it comes out. And then we're testing a detector, a handheld detector, that actually has a video camera that looks down on the bees, and it goes to a laptop with image recognition software. And so you can see this unambiguous kind of signal if the bees are picking up molecules of explosives or not. So it's been very successful, and we've done lots of field trials and lots of laboratory trials, and it looks very, very promising.
So people then who were trying to determine if explosives were present would have bees in some sort of little container, and then they'd look down at them from the camera you mentioned?
Exactly. So the box is about the size of a shoebox, and it can be handheld, carried around, placed next to. When we did our field trials, we had vehicles that were filled with explosives, and we'd walk up to those and kind of interrogate the handles and that sort of thing, and the bees' proboscis would come out, and we would do a... We had a suicide bomber, and we would walk up to that person and hold it. So we also envisioned that they could be used in something like a portal of an airport where people are walking through and the bees are inside. I don't think folks would know that the bees are in there, but they would be doing their job in there. Or also we've worked on incorporating them on a robot, so you could actually drive the box of bees up to a vehicle or something, a roadside bomb, and interrogate it that way, and it would have this standoff capability, which would be much safer for the operator.
Obviously, especially if you had them in the airport, you'd have to seal the bees up. How often do you have to replace them?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, that's one of the disadvantages to the bees, I think, over something like a canine system, is that the bees don't last very long. The longest we've had a bee go out is about 2 weeks in her harness, but that's even a lot longer than we think is reasonable. We're saying about 48 hours is probably what we think any individual bee can really work. So again, it takes a couple hours to train her, then she would be good for a couple days, and then she could be released and go back to the hive. So it takes a little vacation while she's sitting in the tube, and then she goes back to her colony.
How do you avoid, when you're training the bees and putting them in harnesses and all of the rest of it, being stung?
Well, unfortunately, we do. I kind of like it because I like bees, but the analytical chemist I have working with me, some of the other folks, they're not too keen on being stung. But you really don't get stung as much as you might think, because we have a system that you collect them from the hive and put them into a holding cage and things, and people don't even handle them until it's actually time to put them into the tube, and then we use tweezers. And so for the most part, we avoid being stung.
Dr. Tim Harmon, again, principal investigator for the Stealthy Insect Sensor Project at the Los Alamos National Laboratory. Well, dogs don't have stingers. Why is it that bees are better for this purpose than dogs?
I'm not sure I would argue that bees are necessarily better than dogs. I just think there might be some applications that bees would be more appropriate. We know for sure that they're picking up concentrations in the parts per trillion, so that's not a lot of molecules that they can... that they need to pick up a signal. So that's good. That's comparative to dogs. The idea of them being a little bit more covert, it's not as obvious that they're what the detector is. So there's areas that maybe there's cultural sensitivities that you wouldn't want to use dogs. In some parts of the world, it might be better to have bees in a box instead of bringing dogs around. Also the issue of if you're going to really use this technology for roadside bombs or that sort of thing, if the system does happen to get blown up, you lose a few bees and you lose your detector, but you don't lose a handler and their dog. So there's some real advantages there safety-wise, I think, also.
So you can do this remotely? You don't have to actually hold the detector up yourself?
Correct. So the idea being is we really want to envision this kind of standoff capability.
Is this program in operation as yet? Oh, you said there had been field trials. Has there been actual deployment of bees as detectors of explosives?
There hasn't been to this point. Right now we're finishing kind of the proof of principle and all the laboratory work. So that's really what we hope happens next is a serious deployment.
What's it costing to do this research?
We've been working on it for about 18 months, and it was a $1.8 million DARPA research grant.
So, and DARPA is?
Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency.
So if it's less than $2 million, that's a bargain if it actually works.
If it saves lives, it's an absolute bargain.
Tell us a little bit more about the bees and the Pavlovian training. That's usually associated with... different kinds of creatures. How is it that insects are subject to it?
Yeah, so that's not a new concept, using bees for Pavlovian training. Now, the cognitive sciences have used that for a long time, because bees are a really good model system for understanding if you give a bee a scent, looking at the neural pathways and things. So they've been doing that type of training with bees for a while. It's very simple. It's nothing more than this You give them 3 seconds of the odor of interest, in this case explosives, followed by a 3-second reward, and you go through several training rounds, and then at the end of that, every time they start picking up that smell, they'll stick their proboscis out in anticipation of getting a reward. And so there's lots of animals that you can train using this kind of Pavlovian technique of coupling a reward with a smell or some other stimulus. So it just happens that bees have this really great response in that they stick their proboscis out. So it's very obvious when they're doing it.
Would you have to have beehives nearby, or can you transport the bees in suspended animation or by some other means?
Yeah, bees are relatively easy to transport around. You know, even like the commercial beekeeping industry in the U.S. are shipping bees through the mail. You can put them in a box, you could throw them in a plane, you could deploy them. That, I don't think, is going to be a real big issue. Or you could use local bees. You know, if you were different, beekeeping is a global endeavor, and so it would be, in a lot of areas, it's easy to come up with some local bees, and they would do the trick
okay.
as well.
Well, thank you very much for being with us.
Great. Thank you very much.
Dr. Tim Harmon, Principal Investigator, the Stealthy Insect Sensor Project, Los Alamos Laboratory. Today's program produced by Vanessa Romo with Dan Konecki and Francis Anderton, Technical Director Phoebe Zimmerman. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live in podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and
PRI, Public Radio International.